Hi, my name's Meher, and you're listening to Solutions for a Better Planet, a podcast presented by EcoActive ESG. Today, we're joined by Dr. Sybil Diver. Sybil is an interdisciplinary environmental scientist and co-director for the Environmental Justice Working Group at Stanford University. For the last 25 years, she's been doing community-engaged research on indigenous water governance in the Pacific Northwest salmon watersheds, working from an allied perspective on issues of indigenous peoples, salmon, and environmental justice around the North Pacific, in the Russian Far East, Alaska, Canada, and even in the U.S. Recently, she partnered with Karuk researchers on a social impact assessment of the Klamath Dam removal. Hi, Sybil. Thanks for joining us.
It's such a pleasure to be here and talk with you, Meher.
Yeah, thanks. It's lovely. I feel like I've known you for so long, and I'm really excited for other people to hear all the wisdom that you have to share and all the amazing work that you do. I know that a lot of your work and your journey has been centered around environmental justice, and I think this might be something new for our audience. So could you tell us a little bit about what environmental justice is and what it means to you?
Well, I like to think about environmental justice sometimes through Bev Wright, who's a major leader in the field. And environmental justice says that all people deserve to live a life free of environmental harm and with access to environmental benefits. And one of the big challenges that environmental justice scholars and practitioners take on is intervening in some of the disproportionate levels of environmental harm that are experienced by particular groups, often low-income communities of color, alongside the challenge of inequitable benefits to environmental goods. And in doing environmental justice work, we often take on the system. So the systems of environmental racism or other forms of oppression. And that means when we engage with environmental issues, we take on some pretty hard things that are connected to colonialism or connected to our legacies of slavery in our country or other forms of harm and disproportionate access created for particular groups of people.
I always found it really interesting that environmental justice seems to be defined somewhat in the negative. So it's not necessarily always this is what environmental justice is, but it's like sorting through and peeking out all of the elements of what environmental justice is not and where there are elements of environmental racism.
I love that you're bringing that up because it is true. A lot of times we engage with environmental justice as a struggle. It's part of a social justice movement. So we're struggling against something, and that often brings up some of the most challenging and harmful aspects of social systems that are, you know, causing and perpetrating these harms for particular groups. At the same time, if we go to the core of environmental justice and the initial principles of environmental justice established in 1991, those are established really with a vision in mind. For a vision of justice for all. So it's true, we often engage in a negative context at the same time. The idea in the scholarly space is around visioning towards. And that's one of the reasons why some of the initial scholars who were engaging with issues and terms like environmental racism shifted towards environmental justice, because it's towards that vision for something better for all people.
Okay, so it takes the environmental movement and considers social justice situations, and some of that is struggle, but also some of that is creating, I love that idea of creating a vision for what you want out of the future and what does an environmentally just society look like. It's not just what is good for our environment, but what is good for the people that live in that environment and work in that environment and play in that environment. And I think it's interesting because a lot of people, especially in sustainability movements, are not thinking a lot about the social components of what is involved in working with the environment. And of course, humans are necessarily part of the environment. And I know that you've spent a huge part of your career doing specifically community-engaged research. And I was wondering if you could tell us about your journey into doing community-engaged research and why you think research needs to be community engaged.
Thank you. I think community engaged research does really invite a lot of self-reflection on why we as researchers are going into a research space that is not our space.
Mm.
We're entering a space as a guest, and community engaged principals ask the researcher to be aware of that. And when you're working in a community with community-based participatory research, which is a particular approach, there's often a combination of research activities in action, action that you're taking to enable a change to happen that a community wants. But when you're doing work in community, some of the self-reflection that one might do is intended to remind the researcher that you are doing work on behalf of others, and their vision and leadership pre-exists you as a researcher. And so when you enter a new space, there's a lot of learning to do. And there's also a process of negotiating, you know, sharing knowledge, sharing decision making, and also sharing ideas for what are your roles in the collaboration that entails both research and action.
Yeah, and you have done a lot of community engaged research. You are such a superstar in this field, and in particular in California on water rights, especially with indigenous communities and dam removal on the Klamath. And I was wondering, it's just such an interesting story. Could you tell us about why that dam was put on that river in the first place and why it needed to be removed, and your journey in allyship with indigenous communities to make that happen?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm so excited to share about the Klamath story, because the Klamath River is a place that I was introduced to early on in graduate school. Just to share my relationship with that place and getting to know the issues, I had worked previously in the Russian Far East as a translator. I was a Russian language speaker, and so really my language ability invited me into a space where I could start asking questions and facilitating conversations about hard environmental and social issues in the Russian Far East, primarily around community-based natural resource management. In that work, I've started to work on salmon fisheries in Kamchatka, which has 25% of our Pacific salmon spawning on a peninsula the size of California. It's an amazing place. So that introduced me for the first time to issues around indigenous peoples and their strong connections to salmon, and also how what I thought were scientific issues around salmon conservation were very strongly connected to indigenous land rights and contemporary dispossession of indigenous peoples from their land and from the resources that they both depend on for livelihoods and subsistence, and also steward through their traditions. So that introduced me to all these issues overseas. And through doing exchanges between community groups on the Russia side and on the U.S. side in the Pacific Northwest, I got introduced to those same issues in my own backyard. And that was my entry point to learning about the Klamath, where there's a long-time effort led by a number of tribes, Native American tribes, to protect the river and protect the salmon. And these are salmon cultures, salmon people. So salmon has historically been at the root of a sort of essential component of Karuk culture and identity and livelihoods. The Karuk tribe is the tribe that I got connected to in graduate school, which is one of these second largest tribe in California. And it's one of the leaders on the Klamath Dam removal effort. The dams are there. You know, they were initially built for hydroelectric power. There were four dams in the middle section of the Klamath River that were built at different time periods, starting the 1930s through the 1960s. And this was at the time, a lot of extractive resource management happening in the region. There was a need for local power. Those dams were built in part for that, but also part of a history of encouragement and policy and funding for dam removal as a sort of dominant strategy for development in the United States and elsewhere. They were removed, however, because it turns out building large structures like this that block a free-flowing river have significant negative impacts. So the dams are built for power, not for irrigation or for municipal use.
Okay, no, so also not significant water.
No, and they were also not built for flooding purposes, preventing flooding. Some other dams can do that, but these dams were not, just for power, primary purpose. And they were removed because they first were built without fish ladders, which is a device you can construct alongside a dam that allows fish to jump across a gradual grade, a fish ladder,
right,
to reach their destinations upstream. We didn't have that in the case of the four dams that were removed. And as a result, they were blocking fish passage.
And this is important for salmon, because I think to most people, salmon are very much an ocean species. But this river is really important, and rivers in general are quite important to salmon for their spawning, right?
Correct, Meher. That's exactly right. Because salmon have this really fascinating life cycle where they rear, they are born and they rear in the river, mm-hmm. which is a protective environment. Their survival rates are higher in the river, and they get to a larger size growing in the river, and then they go out to the ocean to grow and get big and eating all kinds of rich ocean foods that you know about. And then they return to their natal river, to this place where they were born, to spawn and die.
Okay. So they start their life in this river, and then they end their life in this river. So this is a really important place for salmon. And so if you are damming these rivers, you are influencing the life history and the life cycle of these animals that obviously are both really important to the ocean, but also really important to a lot of native peoples in California, especially the Karuk tribe that you have been working with.
Correct. Yes. And I will say another challenge with the dams is that when you impound a free-flowing river in a reservoir, that reservoir, in the case of the Klamath, was creating these large bathtubs of pools of water that would heat up during the summer. And in those warmer water conditions, Quercistin, a kind of harmful algal bloom, would be produced, and that toxins from that would be carried downstream. Those reservoirs also interrupted natural flushing flows and other ecological processes that arise from disturbance from flooding events that keep the river healthy.
Right.
So those are two additional challenges that affected both the ecosystem and also the health of tribal community members whose lives historically were very dependent on salmon.
Okay, so you have this period in the United States of huge development, part of which includes, in the West especially, putting up a bunch of dams for often hydroelectric power. Right, not including these salmon ladders and not including these fish ladders that allow, at least in some part, some of this life history and the migration up and back from the river to continue. And so then I want to highlight that these dams, it's a huge win. These dams have just been removed very recently, but that was like a multi-decadal struggle, right?
Yeah, you are right. In fact, it's a really exciting story because it was really 20, 25 years of work of advocacy, policy work, and science that led to the dam removal happening in 2023, 2024. So this just happened. And there's a lot of excitement about it, both because, you know, it's an improbable story. It was the dam removal effort was kicked off in response to a huge fish kill that occurred in 2021. Mm. And that fish kill happened in part because of impaired water quality that was linked to low flows and water diversions upstream in the Klamath, where you had just the pathway of the river littered with dead Chinook salmon carcasses as they were on their way to spawn. So these are fish that died without spawning. So it was a very traumatic event. And part of the tribe's response to this was to really look at the water quality issues and to start a conversation about dam removal. And a lot of the first steps were very much around direct action. And a number of the tribes and their allies went to Scotland shortly after this fish kill event and advocated for the current owner of the dam, Scottish Power, to take them down.
Mm.
And that was, so we're going back to early 2000s for this. 2001, I might have misspoken earlier, my apologies, but 2001 was the fish kill. So we're talking early 2000s that all of this started. And one of the exciting things about the whole process of getting dam removal is the trajectory of the initial response. Was we recently did some interviews about the dam removal experience with a number of tribal community members, and they shared that the initial response of a lot of agency folks was to laugh at tribal community members and leaders who said, "We're, you know, what we really need is to take out these dams." And that was initially viewed as being extremely improbable. And through advocacy, through science, through policy work, tribes and their allies really achieved an incredible accomplishment in establishing the political will to take out the dams. And part of this was around these dams were built without fish ladders. So there was an intersection between indigenous rights that was activated through the tribe for the right to practice ceremony, protect the river that is part of their heritage and ancestral territory, intersecting with environmental policies and laws. Some of the salmon runs in the Klamath are protected under endangered species provisions. And as threatened species, state agencies are required to take certain steps to protect those runs. Relicensing a dam without a fish ladder that contributes towards the degradation of the salmon run would not be considered, you know, fulfilling the full responsibility for salmon protections under the law. So that was a leverage point for starting that initial conversation about dam removal. I'll pause there. There are many other exciting elements, but I'll pause there.
Yeah, this is such an incredible story because you have such a grassroots community and tribally led like sort of sounding of the alarms for this species that is really important, not just to this tribe, but also to, like you said, so many ecosystems in California. I think it's really interesting that advocacy efforts can really take advantage of some really interesting policy or other measures like you're talking about, like you can't recertify this dam without a fish ladder. And that is useful. And so I think that is something that gives me so much hope, right? That all these tiny things that seem small in terms of regulations or little policies that feel local can have such huge, like lasting cascading consequences and ultimately result in a huge win, like removing dams and freeing this river and freeing salmon and rebuilding the relationship between people and salmon and the river. That is so beautiful.
Exactly. I agree. And to link it back to your framing for the whole conversation, it's really exciting as an environmental justice moment for this campaign, because and I'll refer listeners to the Undam the Klamath campaign, which you can find online. But the tribal leadership was maintained throughout this effort over 20 years. And that was a real accomplishment for the environmental community to step back at times and sometimes be asked to step back, but to really enable tribes to lead. And that history is, there's some really interesting stories about that you can find through many of the new materials and stories that are out on dam removal. But this was a really new element for a big environmental campaign like this to clearly be led through tribes throughout, with tribal science being part of that, tribal policy leadership, linkages between tribes and environmental lawyers that made this happen. So it's because the idea is sort of connecting back to the rights and also responsibilities of the indigenous peoples of this place to take care of their river.
Right.
And responding to this traumatic event that really clearly established things were not okay. And this isn't okay. Like, this isn't a problem just for the salmon. This is a problem for cultural continuity, for the health of the people, because of the diet of Kuruk people and other indigenous peoples of this area being, you know, linked to access to salmon and other traditional foods that depend on having a healthy watershed, and also depend on the tribe caring for the watershed through a reciprocal relationship. So that as an underpinning for the campaign and for the persistence of the effort to keep going, even though there were so many roadblocks, is quite extraordinary and really speak to the environmental justice moment. I was not part of, I'm engaged as an allied scholar and a supporter, so I wasn't part of that leadership, but I was able to talk to many people over the last couple of years about the meaning and about what was important for the effort. And the second thing I want to highlight about what was really important and extra, you know, really impressive and relevant to the current moment for the Klamath Dam Removal Campaign is something that I talk about as Indigenous peacemaking, because we briefly discussed this fish kill that was one of the sparks for the whole effort in 2001 and 2002. Part of that fish kill is linked to a broader struggle in the upper basin between farming communities that have established, you know, their own livelihoods in the upper basin that depend on water diversions from the river. This is part of a large government sponsored project developing the upper Klamath for agriculture occurring at the turn of the century. So those communities are drawing water from the river and need water for their crops. At the same time, downstream, we have tribes that need water to support their fishery and a healthy river ecosystem alongside fishing communities and others and local residents. That historically created a very tense conflict in the upper basin. So part of getting to dam removal, that process involved a peacemaking effort between tribal and non-tribal communities and farmers and fishermen and tribal fishermen getting together and having conversations, getting past differences and recognizing that everyone was going to lose if they didn't do something. Because the farmers were losing water, the tribes were losing water and losing fish and losing access to cultural resources. Everyone was losing.
Right.
And so people had to sit down, and talking to some of my colleagues, one of my mentors is Ron Reed. He's a tribal dipnet fisherman, and he has shared a lot with me and some of my students also, including in our class, about what it was like to be part of those early conversations that were quite tense, vitriolic at times, like a lot of anger, to still sit with the conversation and get to know not people to the extent that you recognize them as people and you saw them as parents with children, with families. And I think that process, the way I've been told the story, revealed that everybody was pretty much looking for the same thing. They were looking for their kids to be able to continue in their families' footsteps and traditions and to live a good life, to have a livelihood in the place if they chose to do that. You know, there was a lot of common ground with this idea of what's going to happen to our children in the future. And that enabled a set of conversations that precipitated the first set of negotiated settlement agreements about removing the dams.
Wow.
And everyone sat down and said, you know what, we think we want to do this. There's a way to do this so that we can move forward and do this respectfully.
I love also how that relates to what we were just talking about how all of these groups couldn't come together just to put out a fire. They had to really envision what this river could look like. What could this community look like? What could our relationships with the river, with the land, and with each other look like, right? How can we envision a better way of working together as landowners, as tribal groups, as lawyers, as scientists? And I think that is really what you're talking about, is at the crux of environmental justice work, is really trying to, yeah, envision what a future looks like and what you want it to look like. And I also, just in the time that we have left, I wanted to ask about your relationship to allyship. One of the biggest lessons you've taught me is that it's really important to center some of the leaders in this work, right? We talk a lot about how the environmental justice movement has been going on for decades, and there are many, many people that have been leading that fight. And I think it's really easy in the United States to think of tribal leadership on the Klamath as an anomaly, when in reality, there are tribal leaders who have been doing environmental justice work and organizing for decades. For example, in California, we stopped for 100 years prescribed fires and prescribed burns, and now we're left with 100 years of built-up fuel that is causing a lot of our wildfires now. And I just was hoping you could speak to why it's important to encourage and be an ally to specifically Indigenous leadership in some of these spaces.
Oh, thank you. I love that question. Well, I don't think the Klamath Dam removal effort would have occurred without allyship. Just looking at all of the people who aligned behind the tribes. And in my own work, we do, you know, allyship is something I strive towards. You don't get to call yourself an ally. Someone else has to decide that you've kind of passed the bar. But I definitely strive for it because it's both a way to acknowledge the history of Indigenous, non-Indigenous relations in this country that I'm a part of, and to move towards a better relationship than what we've had in the past, to be part of that effort. And how do you know how to do that? Well, it turns out like the best way is to start building a relationship to a point where you know folks in a tribal community, and they can tell you what might be useful. You can try to participate in that.
Yeah, and such a good example of, we as researchers know that when tribal leadership is centered and encouraged, the climate and all of these ecosystems benefit, right? And that's some of the best ways that we have to be allies to conservation, is to center the voices of people who have those kinds of relationships to the land. And like you're saying, to build relationships with those folks and to try and support all of their amazing work. Thank you so much for talking to us, Sybil. It was so lovely to speak with you again. And thank you so much for the work that you do.
Thank you, Meher. And I'm just thrilled to get to be in conversation with you. And I hope some of this is useful for others. I'm glad to talk more.
Thanks.